second open the House Committee on Agriculture and Land Use. Today is March 14th, 2019. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2061. Now, I can't remember, did we hear it before, or we almost did and then decided we needed more time? Okay, so this is our first chance to hear about this. Let me call up Lisa Hansen, and you're bringing Stephanie with you, and then we'll go to my sign-in sheet after that.
Thank you, Chair Klein, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Thank you for time to come and visit with you about the final bill coming from the department this session, and it deals with the registration permit fees for our confined animal feeding operation. This was probably one of the tougher issues that we had to work through of all of the fee bills that we had. And I want to say thank you to the committee for your patience and giving us extra time to work with stakeholders to come to a place where the fees that are in the Dash 1 amendments will meet our needs for the next biennium and support the governor's recommended budget. And then we will continue to have conversations as we move forward in terms of where we need to go with fees over time. But this takes care of the immediate need that we had to readjust and cover one full FTE in the program. I think I'm going to have Stephanie walk you through some of the work because she's done the bulk of it this time. And the Dash 1 amendment specifically. And then we'll be happy to answer questions.
All right. Thank you, Chair Klein, members of the committee. Stephanie Page with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'll start going through the Dash 1 amendment and then happy to share any statistics about the program as well as the revenue that we anticipate the amendment will generate for the coming biennium. So starting on lines 1 through 3 of the amendment, those three lines basically change the proposed statutory cap for fees, for annual permit fees for small, medium, and large confined animal feeding operations that are registered to the general permits. On line 4, that is modifying the proposed application fee for a small, and that's the same case with line 5. So we're just slightly adjusting the application fees for new confined animal feeding operations applying to the general permit. Lines 6 through 9 are modifying slightly the fee to transfer ownership of a confined animal feeding operation from one operator owner to another. So those are this amendment basically modifies the statutory caps that we had proposed in the initial draft of the bill. And the purpose of doing that, as Deputy Director Hansen said, was to get us to a place where we get the revenue that we need to fulfill the governor's recommended budget for the 2019 to 2021 biennium. We anticipate that we would conduct rulemaking to put these proposed caps into rule, and that the rules would take effect for only the second year of the biennium. So we would have 1 year under our current fee structure and then 1 year under the proposed fee structure that you see in the amendment. So we anticipate that, given that that increase would be in effect for only half of the biennium, we would generate about $84,000 in revenue for the 19 to 21 biennium beyond what we already get for the program, with a total of approximately $305,000 total revenue for the biennium.
So why don't you talk about what a CAFO is and what we're permitting and why we permit it, just really quick.
Glad to do that. Generally speaking, confined animal feeding operations are facilities that confine animals during periods of wet weather on a prepared surface or a surface without vegetation, or facilities that confine livestock or have livestock and wastewater treatment works. We have both a state and a federal definition of confined animal feeding operations. So, and many of our facilities in Oregon have both the confinement area and the wastewater treatment works. The purpose of having those facilities registered to the permit and the purpose of the program that inspects facilities for compliance with the permit is to make sure these operations are managing manure and wastewater in a way that protects water quality in the state of Oregon. Some of the examples of facilities that we have registered to the permits include smalt goat and sheep dairies, cattle dairies, cattle feedlots, egg layer operations, broiler fryer operations, dog kennels, and we even have Wildlife Safari as one of our permit holders. Altogether, we have about 524 permit holders in our state. The vast majority of those are registered to our general permits, and we do have five facilities that are registered to individual permits. And those are in generally insensitive areas where we add additional conditions onto the permit, and that's what an individual permit allows us to do. In terms of the staffing in our program, we have six inspectors that inspect our permitted facilities, and generally they do that on an every 10-month basis. That's the minimum frequency at which facilities are inspected. For our individual permitted operations or for facilities that have an issue we need to follow up on, we are out there more frequently.
I think we can probably pause there.
Okay.
Questions for Stephanie or Lisa?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chad Allen, Tammy Kerr, Jerome Rosa. Tammy, or Chad, whoever, actually, if you're,
go ahead.
You can pick.
No, go ahead.
I can take it.
Yep.
Chad's first on the list, technically, so we'll just go that way.
Chair Clem, others on committee. My name is Chad Allen. I'm the current chair of the Oregon Dairy Farmer Association. I'd like to first go off by saying that the dairy farmers of Oregon want an increase in CAFO fees about as much as we want a CAFO fine. But recognizing that most of the time we are used to getting what we don't want or what we don't want, we would certainly like to thank the people at the CAFO department for being willing to work with us on this. We've had a very diligent back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth of different ideas and rates and increases and different ways of looking at this. And through that process, it has been our point of view that we would only be willing to fulfill the budget for one full-time employee. There was some opportunities in that discussion where there was some budgets that had the desire to fund more than one full-time, and we are very resistant and will always be resistant to that. The conversation in the CAFO fee for a lot of years has been wanting fees to cover one full-time employee, and that's what we have in front of us today. And again, we appreciate those at CAFO for willing to work with us and allow us to come up with some different ways of getting to that point. We think what's been proposed is reasonable and something that we could certainly move forward with.
Chair Clem and committee members,
loud enough.
For the record, my name is Tammy Kerr. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and I offer the following testimony on behalf of the 200-plus dairy producers in the state of Oregon. As you can see on the map that we submitted, we have dairy farms in 21 of our 36 counties and 26 dairy farms located here in Marion County. These multi-generational, conventional, and organic family farms work hard 24/7, 365 days a year, and they're very proud of the care they provide for their animals. They produce a high-quality fluid product that ranks among the highest quality milk in the nation, and our producers take pride in our care of the environment. In 2017, the fluid milk produced on Oregon's dairy farms resulted in an economic contribution of more than $500 million in farm gate value. Milk is the fourth most valuable commodity produced in the state, and our value after processing is well over $1 billion. The number of Oregon dairies is directly related to the ability of each farm to withstand the volatility in the price of milk against the cost of feed, labor, taxes, and the ever-changing regulatory burden at the state and federal levels. Milk prices have been decreasing every year for the last 4 years. Our producers receive 40% less for their milk today than we did 5 years ago. Nearly every producer in the state is losing money with every shipment of milk. Milk prices historically shift up and down, but I've never experienced a continued four-year downward spiral like we're currently enduring. The Oregon Dairy Farmers Association was organized in 1892 to work on behalf of the dairy farmers in the state of Oregon. And today we do represent 200-plus organic and conventional multi-generational dairy farms. These farms are extremely diverse, but all are family businesses. And the decision to be conventional or organic is a business decision, and regardless, all grade A dairy farms in Oregon are regulated under the CAFO program. ODFA supports the longstanding CAFO program that's regulated by the Oregon Department of Agriculture for the purposes of ensuring the ongoing quality of water in the state of Oregon. ODFA really appreciates the willingness of the agency to engage in multiple conversations over the last few months for their proposed fee increases for the 19 through 21 biennium. And we're pleased that we could reach an agreement with them on the structure of a fee increase, which is the focus of today's hearing and House Bill 2061. It's been an agreement between producers and ODA that fees would fund one FTE, and the balance of the program would be funded by general funds, which underscores the importance and the value of the program to the public for the work being done to comply with the regulations of the CAFO program. The cumulative expenses of compliance is shouldered by the producer, and the fee is the first step in compliance. For a historical perspective, the CAFO program has been placed in Oregon for the last 25 years. Oregon is the only state in the nation that requires both a CAFO permit and an animal waste management plan for all grade A producers. By comparison, the state of Washington has more than double the number of cows that we do, and less than 20 farms in Washington currently have CAFO permits. Every time our producer, and we consider manure produced by our farms, by our cows, to be a nutrient. So every time our producers apply nutrients to their field, they're required to record the date, the rate of application, the method of application. They must test the nutrient, take soil samples, and make applications at an agronomic rate for the crop that they are growing. Dairy farmers are also required to complete an annual report. Producers are inspected once every 10 months by an ODA CAFO inspector, and more frequently for larger farms. Some of our largest farms currently are inspected up to four times per year. A diagram we submitted outlines the number of state and federal regulations our producers operate under. These regulations come with a cost, and for the record, let me reiterate, the cost of compliance is expensive and time-consuming. With the return on investment continuing at a 20-year low, our producers are struggling. The Oregon Dairy Farmers Association Board of Directors continues to express an ongoing value to the public for the need of the continued general fund dollars to support the CAFO program. ODFA is pleased to have reached an agreement with the department on fee increases. We anticipate the current proposed fee increase will cover one FTE inspector for an additional 6 years. We do not want to be back in front of you in another 2 years discussing more proposed fee increases. Although we have not seen the language of the amendment, we look forward to reviewing the amendment of House Bill 2061 and will continue to work with the agency on a mutually agreeable bill. Thank you for your time and your attention. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Jerome.
Chair Klim, members of the committee, my name is Jerome Rosa, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We represent nearly 2,000 members across the state, and currently, beef is Oregon's second largest agricultural product. In 2019, there are approximately 511 CAFOs in the state. I personally hold one of those permits, which makes me acutely aware of the complexities of the program. There are 30 beef cattle ranching, farming, and backgrounding operations, and 134 cattle feedlots in the state. Combined beef accounts for 164 of the total CAFOs in Oregon. OCA has been and continues to be a longtime supporter of the CAFO program. It's important to maintain a strong and well-respected program. In 2004, there were 583 CAFOs. And in 2019, there are approximately 511 CAFOs, representing a decline of over 12%. Additionally, over 10% of these CAFOs are not in operation, creating a more limited and simplified inspection process. OCA participated in the fee structure discussions, but also sees a need for a more fiscally responsible budget that reflects the aforementioned CAFO declining numbers statewide. In a struggling financial animal ag economy, raising fees is currently problematic. Thank you very much for the time today and the excellent work done by this committee.
Questions for this group? Off easy, thank you. And I've got Dale Skiles.
Good afternoon. My name is Dale Skiles, and I'm here to support the CAFO fee increase. Although I think that it does not go far enough. At this time, the CAFO division gets only about 9% of its operating budget from fees, whereas the other divisions of the Ag Department get considerably more of their operating budget from the fees that they charge. The fee increase that is proposed will do little to change that percentage. I would like to propose that there is a fee for the administration of the permit and then a per head charge for the number of animals in the facility. This does have some precedence in the other divisions, such as the nurseries are charged $148 and then a percentage of their gross income. Also, the Christmas tree growers are charged $70 for the permit, plus $2 or $3 per acre. And the hemp farmers are charged a flat $1,300, regardless of how many plants they have. Yet the largest Tier 3 facility for the CAFO would only pay $840 per permit, not the facility, when you think of the potential impact between these two types of operations. The CAFO has a greater potential. There is never a good time to increase fees, and the industry would rather see a cut in staff rather than an increase in fees. My proposal would be fair and a way to plan for the future. Possibly a study of the Ag Department divisions could be done so that each of the programs receive about the same percentage of their budget from the fees. In conclusion, I am sure that you are aware that the CAFOs are changing. There are more large and mega CAFOs and fewer small. The large should pay the larger share. And thank you.
Questions for Dale? Dale, I am a little bit curious. Anytime somebody shows up and just says citizen and have this much knowledge and this many opinions, is there anything else you can tell us about yourself? I know all the agencies, you know which crops, you must be involved in ag somehow.
I do sit on the CAFO Advisory Committee, but I'm the only one that is not in the industry.
Gotcha.
And I do have an interest in seeing the CAFOs operate on a good basis. And my brother is in the nursery business.
That explains a little bit about your nursery knowledge. Well, thank you for coming down. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay, anybody else here on 2061? Okay, then we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2061 and open a public hearing on House Bills 3085, House Bill 3090, and House Bill 3091. And Ivan, can you join me or join us? And do you want to bring Kristen with you? And let me just double check something here. Okay, so these are all bills I've introduced, along with Representative McLean, Vice Chair McLean, on one of them. And I will not steal Ivan's thunder, but generally speaking, Ivan and I like to work together on how to help with capital for beginning farmers, and we've been trying for a long time to figure out how to get some programs up and running, and this is these three bills are further effort at trying to get lending and incentives for starting farmers. So we may have somebody that fits that bill over here, but we'll wait to hear from Kristen in a moment and hear from Ivan first.
Thank you, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, Ivan Molesky, the policy director with Friends of Family Farmers. These bills are, as Representative Clem noted, an attempt to address some of the challenges that beginning farmers and ranchers and smaller producers are faced with access to capital and access to land. As I'm sure you all know, but I'll just sort of say it for the record, Oregon is sort of at a transition point in our agricultural system. We're seeing the average age of Oregon farmers approaching 70 years old. We're seeing a significant percentage of farmland on the verge of changing hands. Farmland prices are rising. It is challenging, to say the least, to get into the business. And agricultural lending is also very challenging, oftentimes at a significantly higher interest rate than residential lending. Before I kind of describe what each of these three proposals does, I'll just note, if you look at OLIS, there's a roughly 20 pieces of public testimony that have been submitted from different farmers, from some nonprofit organizations, and even from OSU's Center for Small Farms and Community Food Systems in support of these bills, or at least to provide some context. The first bill I'd like to highlight is actually the last one in the list, 3091. So this bill relates actually to the Aggie Bonds program that the legislature overwhelmingly passed back in 2013. Aggie Bonds is actually not lending state money. It's an interest rate reduction program that's in the IRS code. And the intent here is to provide a tax break to lenders who agree to lend to beginning farmers for land and equipment. Currently, under federal law, in 2019, the maximum loan for an Aggie Bonds loan is $543,800. And you could also include equipment in that as well. As part of that total, Oregon actually sets aside $10 million in pass-through revenue bonds every biennium to help facilitate as many of these loans as possible. However, there's only been two loans that have been issued under this program in its lifetime, and both of those were in 2016. Now, it's not completely clear why that is. What is identified in this bill is fees, that the fees to the borrower we believe are potentially an obstacle to participation. So this bill actually lowers the fees that agencies would be able to charge borrowers to something that we believe is a little more commensurate with some of the national scope of some of these programs. The types of fees right now that are being paid are: there's a $250 initial application fee, there's a 1.5% loan processing fee on the total loan with a minimum of $1,500 to Business Oregon, and then also other fees that could be included are out-of-pocket costs for state agencies and fees that may be charged by the state treasurer for document review and processing. That's in addition to any fees the lender may charge. So again, this bill is really just to lower the fees, but it's meant in part to stimulate a discussion. We acknowledge this may not be the only fix that this program needs to be successful, and so we are very much open to talking about other options. Some of those could include authorizing agencies to use an alternative bond counsel. We understand the bond counsel costs are a significant portion. To the extent that state law limits who they can use, perhaps that's an area we could look at to lower those costs. Perhaps we can create a more streamlined, lower fee process for equipment loans, since I think the high fees are in part an obstacle to the smaller equipment loans. And perhaps we need to involve the Oregon Department of Agriculture a little bit more to help ensure that more lenders in part are engaged in this program. Right now, just one lender is engaged in the program. So I could move on to the other bills. I just wanted to give you a quick overview of that one in this context. But this bill, 3091, is really around sort of fixing and hopefully improving how the Aggie Bonds program works moving forward. Whatever makes sense, Chair Clem. So the next two are slightly different. I'll go with 3090 first here. House Bill 3090 is a bill that would create a new incentive program at the Oregon Department of Agriculture, primarily for the purpose of facilitating student loan assistance, tuition assistance, and other ways to help folks. But it's not limited to that. It's at the end of the day, this is about creating an incentive program at the Oregon Department of Agriculture, which we believe is consistent with the agency's 2023 strategic plan, which includes priority items like building a technical agricultural workforce and keeping the next generation of agriculture involved. Right now, ODA is not really involved in this space as an agency, and so this program would be a way to bring the Oregon Department of Agriculture into the discussion around how do we help out beginning farmers at this time, challenging time. And we believe that establishing a dedicated incentive program at the ODA is key to helping make sure that we are helping protect beginning farmers over time. One key piece I will just flag is that the program would allow ODA to set the rules for the incentive program, and it sort of gives them some direction on prioritization around, you know, when there are limited funds, they would sort of target those to, well, not only, you know, those who are attending state universities, but potentially those who are focused on local food production and organic practices. But it's not limited to that. I wanted to make that clear. That's just in a situation where the funds are very limited and you've got to find a way to prioritize. The last bill I'll highlight is House Bill 3085, and this is actually creating a new loan program altogether called the Family Farmer Loan Program at Business Oregon. This is actually modeled in great part on North Dakota's Family Farmer Loan Program, which is administered by their state bank. It's been very successful over the years. It doesn't apply just to beginning farmers. It also applies to producers who have a net worth under $1.5 million. And for beginning farmers, those who have a net worth of under $750,000. This again would be, this would actually be lending state money, like some other Business Oregon's other small business loan programs. We do just like to create one that is focused on agricultural land purchases, equipment, and other sorts of agricultural property. Applicants would have to go provide all sorts of information like you would with any other agricultural loan. The key is that it would hold interest rates low by ensuring that loan terms do not exceed 30 years. The loans would be capped at $500,000, and interest rates would be set at roughly 1% below the current average rate for agricultural loans in the state, but not to exceed 6%. So the goal there is, again, lower interest lending. So these three programs, we think, are important. Part of why we've proposed this last one in 3085 is because we had much higher hopes for Aggie bonds to help address this problem. And so this would not be in lieu of Aggie bonds. This would be in addition to. It's a proven program that's worked in other states, and we would hope that the legislature would support adding these types of tools to Oregon's toolbox to help out beginning farmers and small producers. Thank you.
Kristen, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Klim and members of the committee. For the record, Kristen White, citizen, Hillsboro, Oregon, and beginning farmer. So my name is Kristen. I'm a lifelong Oregon resident and the owner and operator of Shortstock Farm, a 10-acre meat and vegetable farm in Hillsboro, Oregon. And I'm here today to share my support of House Bill 3085, 3090, and 3091. These bills strengthen Oregon's agricultural future by giving beginning farmers the tools they need to succeed, such as student loan forgiveness and access to low interest financing options. My farming journey began 7 years ago at the University of Oregon. I was studying environmental sciences, and for my degree, I had to take a class in urban agriculture. I had not given farming a passing glance. I took this class, I became fascinated. I realized this was the career path I wanted to pursue and began the journey. So for 5 years, I apprenticed and worked on farms in the Willamette Valley. And then 2 years ago, I leased land and started my own farm. And I can genuinely say that growing food for other people is by far the hardest thing I've ever done, but the most rewarding. So without my university experience, I would have never discovered farming. I wouldn't change that experience for anything, but yet now I'm stuck with student loans that inhibit me from getting the capital I need to grow my business. Furthermore, I have seen many enthusiastic young people forced to give up their dreams to farm because they cannot afford to pay off their student debt and farm at the same time. And at a moment when only 1% of Oregon's population is farming, we cannot afford to push out enthusiastic young people. So I support House Bill 3090 because it provides loan forgiveness programs like other public service sectors, and I think it's long overdue that we recognize farming as a public service. Okay, now on to House Bills 3085 and 3091. So, like I said, I'm lucky enough to be leasing land in Hillsboro, Oregon, but I can't set down roots and start a family on leased land. And we all know that the cost of land in Oregon is staggering. For me, it makes it seem impossible to one day own a farm. These bills would ensure that a small farmer like myself could get access to capital at a low interest rate. The profit margins in farming are very small. Farmers cannot afford the high interest rates that often come with traditional lending. And like Ivan said, we're at a time of great transition in our Oregon lands. Over the next 20 years, much of the land will change hands. And if we don't take proactive measures to ensure that that land stays in the hands of responsible stewards, who will buy the land? What will happen to Oregon's landscape? So I sit before you not as the overly enthusiastic environmentalist I was 10 years ago. I stand here as a realist, a business owner, and a boots on the ground farmer. I understand Oregon's budget is tight, but I urge you to prioritize these bills. I urge you to support these bills and strengthen Oregon's agricultural future and invest in Oregon's agricultural legacy.
Thank you very much. Questions for Representative Bossard Davis?
First, I can appreciate the transition that you just made. That was really funny. You went from like environmental activist to boots on the ground business owner. That's hilarious and awesome. It just struck me as very funny. Can you explain, and maybe Chair Klim, can you explain the loan repayment subsidy part of it? I don't understand the loan repayment part, or maybe Ivan, you can. Is that section 1A? You mentioned loan repayment.
Representative Bossart Davis, I'll do my best. So this is, our intent here is to kind of give this to Oregon Department of Agriculture to flesh out through rulemaking with input. The loan repayment subsidy is essentially, so right now, my conception of it is right now at a federal level, a person who is engaged in a number of different public service occupations, sometimes it's rural medicine, sometimes it's nonprofit employment, can receive essentially mm-hmm. a loan repayment assistance if they stick with that career for a decade. There's a big push nationally to help to create agriculture as a public service eligible occupation for this program, but that hasn't happened nationally yet. So a number of states are looking at creating that at the state level, and so that's essentially what the idea is behind this.
Concept follow-up, mm-hmm. please. And then question on the eligibility requirements adopted for the program must give preference to applicants who commit to producing food for local and regional markets or using organic practices. I question that part of it. Why organic and why does it have to be specific to organic? Why not conventional? And also it just says using organic practices. Does that mean some practices, all? Does that mean that where does that part come into?
Chair Klim, Representative Bossart Davis, I understand we've heard this critique of the bill, and this is the kind of thing I think that is something that could be discussed further. It's really an intent, as was pointed out by another representative, this program potentially could be very expensive, and so mm-hmm. we are assuming that at some point the agencies are going to need to prioritize, and the way that we've proposed in this bill is to prioritize those operations that are growing food for local and regional production, and it says using organic practices. And as you note, it doesn't say certified organic. It could include, I would include conventional farmers that may be using interesting practices like cover cropping, mm-hmm. Perhaps even integrated pest management, something to reduce use of pesticides. So it's really just meant to provide sort of a prioritization, but it does say explicitly that it's a preference, it's not a requirement that those be the only practices that are used by the eligible, you know, by the folks that participate in the program.
Okay, a follow-up comment, if okay?
I just want to say my name is at the top of the bill. That particular one slipped by me. I normally would not weigh in with my particular opinions on organic or conventional in the law, but I didn't quite catch that. But the A, I definitely feel strongly about and would not want to take out. B, you know, I try to be agnostic and follow the science on pesticides and whether they're okay or not, and try not to throw too much into legislation on that topic, but yeah.
So now I have two follow-up comments. Yeah. The one is you can also apply organic pesticides,
yeah,
for the record.
Yeah.
And the local and regional markets, that's, you know, defined by whom. And then I do pause when you say giving, you know, some of these aren't answered and you want them to be answered in rulemaking. That always gives me pause to make sure the intent of the legislation and the intent of you as the sponsor and us as the ag and land use, maybe our intent is maybe a little bit more specified before it goes to a agency for rulemaking is my last comment. Thank you.
I have a similar annoying comment, if it's
sorry.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, Representative Williams.
I when we put things like limiting the fee payable to $100 and then we don't have time to come back and review this law for 18 years, and at that point $100 is, you know, very much different from what it was when we put that into place. Just planning for the future that this program will be long and successful and that we would love to see that fee could be more adjustable, keeping it very low, but making sure that it continues to cover the costs that it's intended to cost at the beginning.
You have no idea what you've just walked into.
I'm embroiled.
No, it's very, you're right. And I'm embroiled in a battle on another bill where the people wanting to be able to recover costs over time are not nearly as sympathetic as farmers, and it's in another committee, and I'm making the same exact point you are, which is, look, people have to be able to recover their costs because costs go up because we keep voting for mandates on employers that make costs go up. And so some of us do. Some of us vote for those bills. And so you're right, and I'm now enlist you as an ally on my other issue, which you probably don't want to because it's sort of like sticking up for payday lenders. It's a little bit awkward.
That's going to be fun. I'm glad
yeah.
that's on the public record.
It's the same principle. Yeah.
Chair Clem, Representative Williams, if I could attempt to answer that. That's true. Right now in rule, it's capped at $250. And I think that more, I understand your concern, and perhaps the more important provision there is that overall fees paid to all state agencies would be capped at 1%, so of the total loan amount. So
that I feel comfortable with because that's going to change over time.
That's right, and because this is in the federal tax code, the amount allowed every year goes up a little bit, approximately $10,000. So I just wanted to flag that for your attention.
We benefited from one of these loans. My husband is a high school math teacher, and we had his federal loans paid off through the Department of Ag as a result of BTG in a rural agricultural district.
Fantastic.
They can be life-changing. That's how we ended up being able to buy our house. So expanding access to programs like this for folks like you, I think, is a really, really smart opportunity for us.
I'm trying to think about this issue now that I think about it. Typically, for agencies at least, when we're trying to set a fee, there is a pretty healthy debate about whether to have it in rules so it can be changed more flexibly, or have it in the legislative assembly so there's certainty that for the agency to not just be able to raise it whenever they want. Someone's got to come and actually convince elected officials to change their mind. So I doubt we will find any consistent thread across all the different programs how it goes. But I'm sure I've been inconsistent, been on both sides of the issue. Yep, that one should be in statute. Nope, that one can be in rule. So I don't have a really strong feeling about it. I do know that the agency would certainly come back to us at some point in the Ways and Means process on this bill before it even passes and say, hey, look, we're not even covering our costs now, so fine, you can cap it at 100, but we want money. This, you know, they'll put a fiscal on it to, because they'll believe that it's subsidized. So we're expecting that we may have a negotiation with Business Oregon at some point here if this bill moves out of this committee over that issue. Because
that's fine. I just want to make sure the costs are covered.
Yep. We are talking in that case about the last one, 3091, as the limitation on the fee. It just not the limitation overall on their various fees, but just on the application fee as the limitation. Right now it's about 250. We want it to be 100, but the point is, can they get their cost back from the other things, or over time what happens to that? Okay. Further questions,
comments? Okay, we've got two more speakers, witnesses, etc. on this. So Marianne Cooper and Roger Beyer, can you come join us? Look who's here. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Marianne Cooper here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. We're actually here just pretty narrowly on the issue that you all were recently speaking about with 3090 around the preference for local food systems and for organic practices. At Farm Bureau, we believe that any practice that is safe and legal and works for a farmer is the practice that they should be using if it works for their operation. And importantly, in Oregon, we produce a lot of important crops that are not food crops. And so we want to make sure that all beginning farmers and ranchers have access to programs that will help them keep working lands working, help them get their start as farmers and ranchers, and again, help them use whatever production methods work well for their operation. I will note that we are seeing a very, we're very proud of our engagement with young farmers and ranchers recently. Our young farmer and rancher program has grown from about 15 members that were active in the past couple of years to over 200 statewide now. And they put on a leadership conference this year that they didn't have one 2 years ago. And they had nearly 100 attendees last year, and they're shooting to go even further next year. And so we do see a resurgence of young people looking to come back to the farm, looking to get into farming and ranching, and looking to be involved in agriculture. And I will note that of our YF&R program and the folks around the state, some of them work on farms that produce food crops and directly sell into food systems. Others produce seed that then goes into subsequent farmers that will grow food from that seed. And so when you're looking at the supply chain, you really need to, I think we need to make sure that all farmers and ranchers, whether they're growing a seed crop or the end food crop, whether they're growing grass seed or cattle, that they have an ability to access markets. And I will also note that market access for beef has been a particular, being able to do it locally has been a particular issue. And so you do have folks looking to have to sell where they can and where the markets go. And so I think that we'd prefer that the program really is available to all farmers and ranchers looking to get into the industry so we can support this awesome growing resurgence of young farmers and ranchers that we've been seeing around the state.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marianne, I want to focus for a minute on the statistics, the numbers you were talking about a moment ago, because I think it's important for this. I probably should have asked at the previous panel as well. Has there been a, and I know that Ivan is right when he talked about the average age about 70 right now. So was there like a generational skip? Like, because there is this resurgence, because I keep track of the YF&R, and there's a resurgence, and I know a lot of them, and I really like that. So is it, are they not my age? They're the next step down? Is that what's going on? Is there a resurgence in that generation?
I'm too old for it.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Post, and I mean, in just looking at our membership, I don't know quite how to answer that because I think we do have we have a tremendous number of farmers, I'd say actually across all age ranges. When I look at our leadership and our members that come to events, I think the average age of the kind of owner operator of the farm is that higher age bracket, but we are seeing folks, whether it's the second generation that hasn't kind of fully taken over the operation yet, and our YF&R is open to folks that are just hired and work on farming operations as well. I'd say we actually have pretty good age diversity, but it does seem like there is kind of a crop of, I'd say, 40 and younger farmers that, you know, maybe they had brothers and sisters that didn't come back to the farm, but they are. So it does seem like there's kind of more activity around that group. And I look at like our County Farm Bureau presidents. And this year we had, I think, 5 or 6 new presidents come on, and all of them were under 30, which I don't think has really ever happened to us before. It's pretty cool. And so I don't know if they're, you know, getting more engaged in ag operations and the folks kind of a step up from them. But I think there's decent age diversity in Oregon, but I do think the owner operators do tend to be in kind of the older age bracket. The more seasoned age bracket.
And part of the reason why I asked that is, I don't remember if it's this one or the one of the other ones, but about the college repayment thing is, you know, there was a time when I hope I'm correct, and the farmer didn't go to college, the farmer farmed, and hopefully the kids went to college. And then we had this generation of kids that went to college and said, I don't want to go back to the farm. I'm going to go off to New York and become an actor. Now this next generation seems to be, or becoming.
Those kids coming back now and they're like, oh, I don't want to live in New York anymore, but I have these college loans and I can't afford to farm.
Well, I guess I'm talking about the third then. So there was the original and then the sons and daughters didn't really want to. But the next, is that even a fair statement that, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it just seems like I'm seeing a resurgence, like you said, of 30 and under, which would be a lot of people fresh out of college, perhaps. Maybe they were going to get a degree in philosophy, and they decided, I'm going to be a farmer.
Chair Clem, Mr. Frost, I don't have a perfect answer for it, except that we're seeing it, too. And I will say, and I think what programs like this, I think the folks that often utilize them, if we can increase utilization, would be more folks that are actually even, I think, just getting into farming. And we do see that also in our membership of, we actually have this really cool members down in Lincoln County that they were in the tech industry in Brooklyn and then in Texas, and then they moved to Lincoln County and bought a sheep farm. And they came to our county farm bureau meeting and were like, I was building fence and I have these sheep and I have all these issues that you guys work on that I care about. And they were the kind of folks that I was like, really cool that you got into agriculture. And their story was very, I guess, nonlinear. They're the, I think, perfect candidates for rural broadband because he's still working kind of at his tech job remotely, but has to go into a cafe, I think, in Coquille to like actually be able to do his job. And then she's working on the sheep farm. And we're seeing folks like that come into our membership. And so I do think there is a resurgence of younger people being interested in agriculture and whether they come from ag backgrounds or not, looking to pursue careers in it. And we think it's cool.
Okay. I'm just a frustrated, I want to be a farmer, so it's my life's ambition.
We'd be happy to have you.
I can't find one anywhere for sale. So. Farmer show?
You could marry a farmer's daughter like I did, and then you can do it for a while until the prices tank, and then he can fire you and tell you to go get another job. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Or you can schedule an appointment.
Right, that's right. He's passed away. I've forgiven him.
My wife's a teacher. I just live off her anyway.
Further questions or comments?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, is Roger here?
Yeah, sorry. We've lost control of the committee again. Roger, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Byer. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council. So I honestly don't have much to add that Marianne didn't already speak to. I mean, just to reiterate that point, that our seed growers in the state, very few of them use organic practices. There really isn't a large demand for organic grass seed. Once in a while, there is they get a call for an organic seed lot, but it's very limited. And secondly, about 98% of our product gets shipped out of state. And not that we necessarily want to ship our product out of state, but we have about 4 million people in the state of Oregon. And when you're produced somewhere in the excess of, about 900 million pounds of grass seed, that would put a lot of grass seed over a lot of lawns in the state of Oregon if we kept it all here. But in reality, most of our grass seed is not used for lawns. It is we feed the world with our grass seed, in that a majority of cattle in the United States are finished on seed that is grown in Oregon, either annual ryegrass or tall fescue. We are producing food. Our seed is used as cover crops in the Midwest, specifically where we are cleaning up the Mississippi River with annual ryegrass seed that is one of probably the best scavenger of nutrients out of the leftover nutrients in the soil from corn and soybean productions. And it also at the same time increases yield of corn and soybean for those farmers if they choose to use grass seed and eliminate tillage in their fields. We're also finding out now that the annual ryegrass is the best thing they found in Kentucky to break the frangipan, which is a layer in the soil. It's established after basically centuries of farming there, plowing at the same level. The annual grass seed is one of the first crop they found that actually the roots will penetrate that and allow the other crops in the fall to get the roots down there and get some of those nutrients below. So our grass seed is feeding the world, even though not many people actually eat the grass seed. And so we, I guess, would take exception to those two pieces in the bill. This is House Bill 3020. I apologize. I didn't make that point to start.
3090.
Thank you. So with that, that's really all I have to say about it. I would like to comment on your question, Representative Post, about the aging of farmers. And while the USDA statistics show the farm community is aging, I don't believe, at least in Oregon, that is any different than the demographics of the age of the society in general. Many of our farms, if not probably most of our farms, are multi-generational. But when you fill out the form for USDA, they ask you for the primary operator, the primary owner of the farm. So whereas that person who still, you know, his name is on top of the farm, his or hers, and they are aging, they have two or three generations under them working on the farm at the same time. So yes, the average age is growing older, but the average age of Americans and Oregonians is growing older at the same time. So I don't think it's really necessarily a big change. It's just that it's the way USDA asks the question is it kind of skews that statistic. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Roger. Representative Bossart
Davis. One comment, please.
Okay.
I was just going to comment that annual ryegrass sounds pretty awesome.
Annual ryegrass is awesome. Thank you for the question, Representative Bossart. And it's amazing what we're finding about that, but the root system in annual ryegrass is incredible. In a single growing season, they can be more than 36 inches deep in the soil profile.
Representative, why do you ask that
question? I just found it fascinating.
Oh, okay.
Further questions? Okay, the only comment I'll make, and it could be a deeply held conviction, it could be an effort to get Jeff Stone to come to my office and visit me. So if we amended it to be that seeds that then lead to food, but for example, not just nursery stuff that just goes in somebody's yard, is somehow more important, then could we all agree? Because we're feeding people, we're causing world hunger, we're not just like making lawns pretty. Or no, can we not go there as Farm Bureau?
And breaking up frangipan.
No, but we're feeding people, like pears. People eat them, and then they live.
And cannabis growers would be able to use this bill.
we'll get out of this. Let's just retract my statements, and I will.
Hold that one in my pocket at the very end just to walk away.
I admit when I'm defeated.
Mr. Chair, I have to tell
Representative
on
Helm.
Representative Bossart Davis. She leaned over and asked this very question about 10 minutes ago.
Oh.
On top of it.
Rep Helm told me not to.
The hemp part is, you can, it's got seeds, you can chew on it.
Oh, it's got great oil.
Yeah,
they make magical waffles things. And stuff.
The other stuff. I'm just going to let me close. Anybody else here on any of these bills? I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 3085, 3090, and 3091. Anything else for the good of the order? Enjoy the broadcasters event if you all would like to go in 45 minutes. Otherwise, have a good weekend. We'll see you next week.
Well, nice weekend.
Thank you.
See, Clem.